Hello and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. In very much a stock-based conversation today, we are covering the big US tech companies that have so disrupted incumbent business models, but also been such a dominant force in helping US equities continue to outperform their global peers. But there's no shortage of controversy in amongst those names, including Tesla. And here is our guest, Gary Robinson of Baillie Gifford, and an owner of the stock, assessing his view on the company's threats.
So I'm much less worried about the threat posed by the likes of the incumbent auto companies in Detroit and Stuttgart and Munich. I'm much more interested in what's going on inside of Alphabet with Waymo, for example.
So for some more detail behind that view, but also insights into the most frequently discussed innovators and tech businesses in the US, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and this week we are looking at US equities. In particular, we're looking at those exceptionally high growth businesses, the household names that include Amazon, Tesla, Facebook, Netflix. And we're doing that with the co-lead manager of the Baillie Gifford American Fund and the Baillie Gifford US Growth Investment Trust. His name is Gary Robinson, and we're delighted he is here with us today. And I think we'll kick off with the biggest holding across your product range, that is Amazon. It's a share that's done exceptionally well, but one has to question how much upside is left in the business. Where do you see the value?
That's a really good question, a really important question. It's a question that we continue to ask ourselves. I think it's an important discipline for growth investors to continue to reappraise the upside in companies that have done well. Now, when we look at Amazon, it might sound a bit ridiculous to say this, but we feel like it's still early. You know, Jeff Bezos himself says it's still day one, and actually it feels that way with Amazon. You know, in spite of the fact that this is a $1 trillion market cap business that's likely to produce revenues of well over $200 billion this year, and I think, you know, That's down to a couple of things. The first is that you know, the markets that Amazon is addressing are truly huge. Although Amazon's a $200 billion plus revenue business, it's addressing markets like global commerce, which is $20 trillion in size, and global IT services, which, depending on how you measure it, might be $1 trillion or up to $3 trillion in size. And so, you know, when you frame the scale of Amazon relative to the scale of its opportunity sets, it's still a pretty small business. And what's most exciting is it's a company that's getting stronger as it gets bigger. It's actually getting faster as it scales. And we think this is a sign of a truly exceptional growth business. So, you know, in recent periods, Amazon's revenue growth rate has been approaching 40%. You know, a year and a half, 2 years ago, Amazon was growing revenues in the mid-20s or something like that. So growth is accelerating as this company gets bigger, which is really unusual in a company of this size. And it really comes down to the fact that Amazon gets stronger as it gets larger. It competes on price selection and convenience. And every year, the company gets better at these things. And so as we look forward, given the scale of the opportunity sets and the competitive edge that Amazon enjoys, we still see significant upside, even from a $1 trillion market cap.
So let's have a think about the shift to online shopping, to e-commerce. I mean, it's sort of a quite fairly well understood shift. But do you have any insights into how far it can go, how mature we are in that transition?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's underappreciated about e-commerce is that even in mature markets like the United States, it's still really early. So something like 12, 13% of commerce is transacted online, even in the United States. And I don't know where that caps out, but I think it's a lot higher than 12, 13%. Maybe it's 30, maybe it's 40, maybe it's 50. But I think the main thing is there's lots and lots to go for. And then you look at markets like India, where Amazon seems to be emerging as a leader or the leader, and that's much less mature. So it still just feels really early for us.
And what about on the AWS, this sort of cloud computing? It wasn't long ago that no one was really talking about it, and then it was sort of underappreciated. And now we're sort of thinking, well, maybe there's threats from competitors, you know, like Microsoft Azure and things like that. You know, where is the AWS in its life cycle?
I mean, this is a market which again is enormous, and you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be a winner takes all market to be a very attractive market for Amazon. Having said that, Amazon is miles ahead. It's difficult to divine just how big Microsoft or Alphabet's cloud services businesses are because of the way they present the data. But our feeling is that Amazon is still quite a long way ahead. And importantly, Amazon is generating serious profits from this business. It's a 25% operating margin business with similar returns on assets. And so that's creating enormous amounts of value for Amazon shareholders. You know, as I said, the market opportunity could be as large as $1 trillion to $3 trillion. So, you know, based on current run rates in the 20, 30 billion range for Amazon, there's lots and lots of runway. I think with a lot of these disruptive businesses, I'd put Netflix into the same category. It's less about the Netflix versus Amazon Prime Video versus Hulu, or the Amazon Web Services versus Google Cloud versus Azure, and much more about these new companies, these new business models versus the entrenched profit pools, the incumbents, and how these incumbents are going to respond.
Okay, well, a couple of names there we want to sort of go on and talk about, but sort of round out with Amazon, and maybe we'll round out all of these names with a regulatory related question. You know, Amazon seems to get in the firing line, certainly from the White House, but maybe Facebook and Google are more in the sights for regulators. But you know, what are the regulatory risks out there for Amazon? And you sort of think about this environmental, social governance element. You know, to what extent the final mile, the deliverers, how well they're being treated. You know, what is the regulatory risks to Amazon and the way it runs its operations?
I think of all the large technology companies, you know, Amazon is really on the front foot as far as this question is concerned. And you know, Jeff Bezos has been very clear in saying, you know, as a large company, you know, Amazon employs over 500,000 people globally now. As a large company, we deserve to be scrutinized. We want to be scrutinized, and we want to get better. And no company's perfect, and all companies will make mistakes. And you know, particularly companies that are growing at 40% year over year is a challenge to manage that growth. And so I think Amazon understands the need to engage on this topic. Amazon understands the need to listen. I think Amazon is serious about improving and understands that, you know, in order to build a strong and durable business for the long term, you need to think about all of your stakeholders' needs. And that's not to say that they won't make more mistakes in future, but they get it.
Okay, well, let's move on to what I wanted to say was sort of described as a controversial stock, Tesla. But I don't actually think it's that controversial. I think everyone hates it. That would be my observation from the investment sphere. But obviously, one company that doesn't hate it is Baillie Gifford. You've held it in size. You've had a very good run out of it. But of course, the last sort of 12 or so months, it has been less of an enjoyable ride. And certainly, you know, coming under scrutiny from investors, perhaps to a degree because of its rather the big personality of its CEO. So we'll tackle some of the issues, but perhaps just from the top, you could tell us a little bit about the investment thesis behind this business and you know, refresh us with where it's come from and what it's achieved.
Yeah, so you know, I think the investment case is actually quite simple. There are two things that need to happen or that you need to believe in order to be bullish about Tesla. The first is this question of whether EVs will become mainstream. And you know, I personally think that that's inevitable. We can debate the timeframes that happens over, but I think it's inevitable. And then the second important question is, will Tesla emerge as a major force within the EV market? Not the only EV company, not even the dominant EV company, but a major player. And we think that that's probable. You know, focusing on, when we think about Tesla, we try to not focus on the sort of 1 week to the next or 1 quarter to the next and think much more about the big picture. And, you know, if you go back and look at the master plan, which Elon Musk laid out just over 10 years ago, and measure the company on that rather than on some of the shorter term targets, they've actually achieved an enormous amount. And it's really, you know, this first question of will EVs become mainstream? My confidence in that is in no small part down to Tesla and what Musk has achieved with Tesla. Tesla has made electric vehicles cool. Electric vehicles weren't cool before Tesla. You know, Tesla are producing cars which are desirable. Forget that they're electric cars. They perform well. They handle incredibly well. They have they're really safe. They have software that's good and that works. You know, these are all attributes that are desirable in any car, not just an electric car. And so in doing this and producing a car which people really want to buy, I mean, the Model 3 launch was the biggest consumer product launch in history. You know, I think what Tesla's done is really sort of pulled forward this. And this is important for humanity because, you know, everyone, I think, understands that we need to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. You know, I think Tesla can be credited with accelerating our progress towards that goal.
So, you know, no new questions to throw at you, I guess, as a from the bearish front. But, you know, what of the competition? I mean, is it the case? I mean, in your sort of starting pitch there is that, you know, the Tesla investment case isn't built around no competition, but you know, what are the serious threats to Tesla in being a dominant force in the electric vehicle market? And you know, what, you know, how far along do you think they are? How far behind Tesla do you think they are in sort of bringing cars to market?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things which has been slightly overlooked recently is just that Tesla's coming out of production hell. I think one of the critical questions is, can they produce the Model 3 at scale? And you know, so I think the figure was that in August, the Model 3 was the fifth best-selling car in the US by volume, and the best-selling car by value. Not electric car, not premium sedan, but car. So I think we're well on the way to answering one of the questions that if we'd sat down 6 months ago would have been sort of the critical vital sign. Can they produce a Model 3 at scale? I think the signs are that they're going to be able to do that. And so it's really about execution from here and continue to do what they have been doing. I think the demand is there. I think the technology risk has pretty much gone with Tesla. They've proven that they can do this. And so it's really about execution.
So, yeah, I mean, Tesla has come a long way, but do you think the competition are sort of anywhere close to disrupting or hitting the sort of production numbers that that Tesla are delivering on?
The difference between a disruptive innovation and an incremental innovation is that disruptive innovation changes the nature of competition, and I think electric vehicles are a disruptive innovation, and the things that mattered for internal combustion engines, like engineering, prowess, fuel economy, those sorts of things, they don't matter anymore. And new things matter, like scale and battery technology, and software. And when the nature of competition changes, incumbents don't often do very well. So I'm much less worried about the threat posed by the likes of the incumbent auto companies in Detroit and Stuttgart and Munich. I'm much more interested in what's going on inside of Alphabet with Waymo, for example. Because I think, particularly on the software side...
Well, that's all right, because you hold Alphabet as well, don't you?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Well, let's move on to... Well, actually, let's sort of close out on Tesla. Sorry, I know this gets a lot of airtime. What is it... What would really worry you as a holder of the Tesla shares? I mean, is it not just the big personality, the CEO? You know, what in the way it conducts its operations would concern you as a holder that may make you a little bit more cautious?
You know, when we think about companies, we focus on the probability of achieving significant upside, and there are lots of reasons why. You know, this might not work. And what Tesla's trying to do is really, really hard. And, you know, the important thing for us is that if they do succeed in this task, then the rewards on offer are very, very significant indeed. And we think this is still a very significant probability that they will succeed.
Okay, fine. Well, let's move on to excellent rather than just fine, Gary. Brilliant. let's close out then with Netflix. Just because we sort of saw recently the bid from Comcast for Sky, you know, their huge amount of money paid, desperate for subscribers, access to customers, and you know, Netflix clearly, you know, stealing a march on many businesses. They've got a fantastic sort of consumer base in the US and outside of the US. But again, I guess it all sort of, well, perhaps you want to reiterate how well it's doing for us, and then we can sort of come on to the threat of competition.
I think on your question on competition, isn't it really interesting that the way that the incumbents are responding to a threat from a disruptive company is by buying other incumbents?
Yeah, well, I guess there is the incumbents. Yeah, have an existing client base, subscriber base, and I guess it's maybe a little easier for shareholders to swallow.
Sure. I mean, I think Netflix is one of the most underappreciated companies in America. I think it's showing signs of being a truly exceptional growth company, where what we're seeing is accelerating growth as the company scales. And that's almost a feature of the business model, where this company gets stronger as it gets bigger. And the bigger it gets, the harder it is for others to compete with it. It'll probably spend more on content this year than any other company in the US. And that gap's only going to grow over time. The nature of this content creation business is that the more subscribers you have, the lower the cost of content per subscriber. And then the more you can spend on content and the more subscribers you attract, and so on and so forth. And Netflix is the first example we've ever seen of a global content distribution business. So take what we've seen in these local markets in terms of profitability of the leaders, and then multiply it across the world. And I think what we could have over the very long term here is a formidable business.
Okay. And then there is concern, isn't there, about sort of the bubble in content creation. I mean, not least fueled by Netflix, that, you know, the amount that they're spending on it. I mean, I know you sort of look at these businesses on the long term, but you know, is there sort of a bubble in that content creation?
Well, Netflix already makes healthy margins in the domestic US market, and its international margins are inflecting. So it's spending more on content every year, and its margins are going up. I think in a business like this where you're able to amortize your cost of content across all of your subscribers, what is a rational price for one company is an irrational price for another company. So I think the prices that Netflix is paying for content right now will prove to be rational in the long term, given the potential.
Okay, Gary, well, let's finish up the conversation on Facebook. Clearly some in the headlines recently for the management change, or the founders of Instagram deciding to leave the business, but Facebook itself coming under some regulatory scrutiny, some intense regulatory scrutiny this year. Can you remind us of your investment thesis on the business and to what extent the news of Instagram management departing the business, how that disrupts your story?
Yeah, so I mean, Facebook owns the most important social and communication assets outside of China. Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Messenger. You know, you have over 2 billion people who use the Facebook app monthly. You have a billion monthly active users on Instagram. You know, these platforms have a lot of value to a lot of people. These platforms still continue to generate very, very significant engagement. You're absolutely right in that Facebook has been grappling with issues, and the company have been very open in acknowledging these issues. And I think they're really some way down the path towards addressing a lot of these issues. And the management team there have been very public in acknowledging the need to invest in order to assuage some of these concerns. You know, we think that there's still lots of potential for these assets over a 5 and a 10 year view. Instagram is still at the relatively early stage of monetization. WhatsApp and Messenger barely at all. And you know, I think history in the sector has taught us that you know, dollars will follow monetization ultimately in these businesses. And I think Facebook, for all the sort of criticism that Zuckerberg's come under, they've done a pretty good job of balancing engagement and monetization over the long term. With regards to the departure of the two Instagram founders, I've seen a lot of speculation on that. I don't know exactly what happened behind the scenes. I haven't had a conversation with Facebook about that. What I would say is that Facebook bought Instagram when it was a small business. They paid $1 billion for it. It's probably worth 100 times that now. It was a great acquisition. I think it was a phenomenal capital allocation decision from Mark Zuckerberg that came under quite a bit of scrutiny at the time. But at that point, Instagram had something like 13, I'll get the numbers wrong, but 13 employees, 10 million users. And, you know, under Facebook's stewardship, it's been built in from a product into a proper business. And, I think that Facebook will continue to be a good steward of that asset, and I can't really say much on why the specifics of why the two founders left.
Okay, well, listen, Gary, we've covered a lot of ground there and talked about some pretty big, serious companies. But you've done a fantastic job in sort of laying out what is the sort of the core vision and the core investment thesis behind each, and. Well, so far, so good. In fact, you know, I don't know how many years Baillie Gifford have been doing it. Gary, over to you.
Doing
managing growth assets in the US.
For a very long time, so for over 100 years.
I don't think you've been there quite that long. You know, we've certainly had sights on the US Growth Trust and the Baillie Gifford American Growth Fund, and of course Scottish Mortgage, and what a fantastic job that's done for clients. So we congratulate you on that, and thanks again for all of your content in this podcast. To our listeners, thanks very much for listening. Let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Bruin Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, however you listen to this podcast. But until next time, many thanks for listening.